My name is Glenn Gersmell. The title of this session is currently Sorting Out the New World Disorder. And I have on the board a list of areas of conflict right now. There's over 30, but I've listed a couple from each continent: Bosnia and Chechnya, the Kurds in Turkey in particular, and West Bank and Gaza for the Middle East, Haiti, Guatemala, El Salvador for Latin America, Kashmir, East Timor, Cambodia, and then a non-shooting conflict, North Korea, and then finally Rwanda, Somalia, Angola as a few places where there's conflicts and problems in Africa. And then down the other axis, several aspects of civilian impact beyond the pure military one: economic stress and hunger, dislocation, the refugee problem, political repression, ethnic conflict, weapons that target civilians in particular, like anti-personnel mines, and then a couple categories of outside forces either assisting, and under that, diplomacy, humanitarian aid, economic sanctions, peacekeeping, peacemaking, or outside forces that are exacerbating problems like economic stresses, the arms trade and military training, colonial links, and so forth. We went around and introduced ourselves. If you could just share your name and if you have a particular interest.
You're the only one's on tape. Betsy is good.
My name is Betsy Nagel.
Which one of these conflicts?
Oh my goodness. Haiti, I suppose. I've just met somebody.
Well, that makes sure he has to talk about everything.
What was it again?
Haiti.
Haiti, okay. Well, I'm going to pick one from each column, as they say, and say a few words about it, and then sort of open things up, and we'll see if we can't touch on at least most of the things that you shared. Welcome. Can you share your name and where you're from, and if you have a particular interest that you bring to the session?
My name is John Cooley. I'm from Mesa, Arizona. Any special interest?
Okay. You can express it as we go.
Bosnia. Yes.
Oh.
Ethnic cleansing. I'm pretty worried about that.
Well, let's segue right into Bosnia. 1992 was the quincentenary of the New World reaching the Old World reaching the New World. Pick a neutral way of expressing that. It was a milestone on the road to European unity. For half a dozen years, that was a big topic in the editorial and business pages in particular. 1992 also saw Sarajevo and other Bosnian cities slowly bombarded to pieces, their inhabitants starved before television eyes of the world. And in fact, the eyes of history a generation from now might well remember that third event to be more important, more critical, more history worthy than either of the other two, despite all of the hoopla about the other two. 1992 saw 2 million Bosnian Muslims threatened with Europe's first genocide since World War II, most already driven from their homes by massacre, rape, and terror. Branka Magas, who wrote what I think is probably the best work, academic or popular, and there's really quite a few good ones. People have referred to Bosnian ghosts, or Balkan ghosts rather, the Fall of Yugoslavia, Mishi Glenny's book, a couple others that I've read or looked at, Yugoslavia Inferno, or one that focuses on the ethnic issues, Yugoslavia's Ethnic Nightmare. Both of those last two do quite a bit. David Reif's really depressing book entitled Slaughterhouse are just a few of the books that have come out just in the last year. Branka Magas is a scholar who's worked for more than a decade on Yugoslavia, and has written articles in quite a few publications, both political and general interest ones. And I'm going to just share a paragraph or two from the introduction of her book, where she talks about the terror and the concentration camps and the refugees, all occurring with the full knowledge of the outside world, which is also quite aware of the identity of the perpetrator, who has been perfecting these procedures for over a year now in occupied Croatia, including the zones formerly under UN jurisdiction. Year has seen Bosnia's legal multinational government holed up in Sarajevo, treated as a mere warring party, and pressed to surrender by Western governments eager for peace at any price. Short-sighted and cynical, divided among themselves, determined to avoid intervention, seeking an eventual accommodation with the military strongmen of the Balkans, these governments have settled for humanitarian palliatives that amount to little more than prolonging of the victim's agony. The same governments protested loudly about ethnic cleansing only when the reality was exposed by their media months after they first learned of it. And she goes on to describe the really sad excuses that Balkan or even all Eastern peoples, frequently referred to tribes, rarely as real nations, are somehow genetically programmed for violence and thus equally to blame. She says, there can be no excuse this time that we didn't know. The search is thus on for reasons to excuse inaction, and she lists five. For example, nostalgia for the Yugoslavia created by the partisans, finally buried in 1991 when a so-called People's Army outside legitimate political control attacked Slovenia, which just tips upside down that excuse. Or repugnance at nationalism that makes no distinction between mobilization behind an expansionary chauvinistic project on the one hand and mobilization in defense of national sovereignty or even existence under military assault on the other. Resentment of Germany, ignobly fostered by weaker post-imperial powers like Britain and France for their own petty purposes. And perhaps the last one, above all, cynical indifference to the democratic rights of other people. She quotes some headlines or sentences from articles that have appeared in the last couple of years. Why couldn't they have waited? Recognition of other countries. Or it was all the fault of the Germans pressing for recognition. And that was a kind of a sparking issue. Bosnia-Herzegovina was never viable as an independent state. Lame excuse. Ethnic cleansing is dreadful, but you know they all do it. Wrong
they
as well as
they
all the different groups there. Yeah, really. Or once the lid came off, old ethnic passions, goes back to World War II, goes back centuries, warring factions, competing nationalism, And she sort of summarizes that the obscurantist litany is unending. I think it's one of the most shameful things that's happening now. And it's, you know, Europe bears perhaps the cardinal responsibility. And yet, in all fairness, you have to acknowledge the political weakness and chaos even of the political scene in Italy, the inability of Germany to actually be up front, given the past. I mean, the Nazis armed the Croatians and more Serbs were killed in that period of the conflict than had been killed up until at least the middle of 94 the beginning of 94, so that, you know, there at least for a brief period was some kind of reason to look back further than just a few years. Britain, again, some political weaknesses and a transition that left them weaker politically to act. France just went through a transition, but had some reasons why they had found it difficult to act. And of course, the United States, with a president that like many Democratic presidents, was perhaps weakest on international security and had the added burden of not being willing to say why he didn't, you know, sign up for the military in 91. There's a wonderful op-ed piece I'll interject on the side that I wish somebody would mail Clinton, or he would have found 2 years ago. During the campaign, the most highly decorated officer alive, the Vietnam period, Colonel Hackworth, really a very smart fellow, wrote an op-ed piece in which he said, "I, a serving officer in the military, at the time that Clinton avoided the draft, was helping all of the people under my command to figure out ways either not to go to Vietnam or in some cases even to leave as conscientious objectors." I mean, nobody in their right mind wanted to join that war at that point. And for people to criticize him and just sort of see Vietnam without any kind of awareness of the period that we're talking about are just really fools. It was just a rivetingly well-written and devastating critique of the people that were criticizing Clinton. But Clinton has been unwilling, for basically because of the polls that he reads, you know, or, you know, his advisors, to engage that issue and to basically come out and swinging instead of, you know, basically taking it in the chin repeatedly about the avoiding the draft issue. In any event, the result has been missed opportunities to step in with force, if that's your preference, or perhaps more important, and I think more what I feel still represents the most important opportunity in Bosnia, to stop giving full, like, diplomatic cover and recognition to characters like Milosevic, and to expand what kind of diplomatic and recognition and political support happens when Western governments and the United States relate to the various actors in the field, to expand that to include those folks that are doing nonviolent kinds of things, those folks that want to retain some kind of semblance of political order, those leaders, religious, community, political leaders who are looking for positive, you know, solutions to the situation. What's happened is very much what happened in Germany in the 30s. There's a kind of an interesting parallel with the economic problems that happened after the death of Tito and the political problems that resulted. The most extreme folks, you know, manipulated passions and ruthlessly, you know, exploited opportunities and exterminated opposition to rise to the tops of several of the competing factions, and many of the other political leaders look like the Weimar leaders, you know, really incapable of really of grabbing the situation and doing anything with it, and the result is what we see night after night on the television. Interesting. I spoke with a pastor, Lutheran pastor, in Virginia, who just got back from Croatia, and I hope I don't get it wrong, because it was just a phone call right before I left, and he's mailing me some stuff. But if I remember the story accurately, it involved the organizing and support through some Lutheran funds of a couple hundred women, wives of people who had either had to leave or, you know, trying to rebuild, who went to the homes of the political adversary. And so when the knock on the door came from their countrymen to look for the men to arrest or to drive into refugee status or to rape or whatever, they were met by these women as, you know, like their friends, saying, you know, you basically by their presence saying, you can't come in here and do whatever you have in mind to do. A couple hundred. I mean, that's the kind of thing that both ought to be in the media more, but also ought to be getting whatever support, you know, can be mustered. those people that say, you know, ancient ethnic passions, hopeless, are doing a tremendous disservice. The reality in Yugoslavia is that most everyone who lived in Yugoslavia, particularly the urban areas, lived alongside of, worked alongside of, and had intermarried with all of the other ethnic groups. I mean, and Sarajevo and the rest of the Bosnian, you know, remains are continue to be a testimony to the possibility of a multi-ethnic state. I mean, Serbia's aggression can simply not last much longer, just purely because of the survival of the Bosnians. I mean, it gives the lie to what Serbia is both proclaiming and attempting to enact. But
because
it's,
there's Serbs who are still part of this.
Yeah.
Right. That's the point.
Right. And for, you know, the West has a black eye. That's much too mild a term. Just purely on its already fractured and frayed relationship with the Muslim world. I mean, just out of self-interest, Western Europe and the United States had reason to try to, you know, help out the situation in more than finding how much they can give away of Bosnia's land and potential and so forth. I mean, allowing the carving up that occurred by the Serbs. And, you know, to say that, you know, lifting the arms embargo is the best we can do is just shameful. I mean, on the face of it, it would be fair. It would level the playing field a little bit. The Serbs are having a much easier time getting arms. The vast majority of armor and artillery was grabbed by the Serb side. 75% of the officers in the Yugoslav army were Serbian, and they went that away and took along the equipment. It was a terribly unfair conflict when it became military, but it could only widen the war. But if the West and the United States don't do any more than we've done in the last year, I have to say I don't think we have moral grounds to say no, don't lift the arms embargo. But I think what we do have a moral requirement to do is to push our country and push our political leadership to do something, you know, to engage that situation in a more powerful way.
In this instance, when you say America and the West, does that also apply to the Soviet Union where Bosnia is concerned?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I would caution against, I mean, the Soviet Union has a relationship with the Serb side that can prove fruitful. I think there has to be a basic boilerplate caution about not blaming the Soviet Union for corralling the Serbs. I would want to push them all I can, but we operate from very weak footing to do so, having done virtually nothing or less.
I'm not saying blaming them.
Yeah, no, but I'm just adding that on. Yeah,
part of it.
I think a stronger leadership from either the United States or Europe or both would be in a position to invite some additional steps from the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union could be the critical actor in it, in the game, and I think it would be reason to offer more than we've offered the Soviet Union in terms of rebuilding, in terms of, you know, dealing with their mafia problem. I mean, whatever, you know. In fact, the economics are so important. I'll just say one word about that. The Republicans have fomented and added to a kind of a undercurrent in political life in the United States of cutting foreign aid, and it is as cynical and shameful a charge as exists in the political world today. The notion that we are somehow providing charity to all kinds of poor, ungrateful countries is simply the furthest thing from the truth. Many, I would say most of the industrialized nations give a higher percentage of their GNP in real foreign aid than we do. And Japan and Scandinavia, it's like almost an order of magnitude. It's like 6 or 8 or 10 times as much. Most of our aid, our foreign aid, goes to rich countries. Like 7 out of the top 10 countries that receive aid are not poor countries. Most is military aid. Those are overlapping categories. The amount is a tiny fraction of what any thoughtful human being would want to go there. To use that as a whipping boy when there's so little economic aid out there to start with is just preposterous. It's just a drop in the bucket compared with lots of other places you could cut if you want to cut, but certainly a drop in the bucket compared to other kinds of spending. And just to pick one piece of it out, it's not even to like the poor and starving kinds of countries, which is most people's conception of foreign aid. The amount of money that we, the United States, is giving to Russia and the former Soviet republics is just unbelievably small. Most of it hasn't arrived. We've promised it, but it doesn't ever get there. And much of it is, here's $2 billion to buy American products, which, you know, it's better than nothing. But just to set that in perspective, West Germany, in the process of amalgamation of the Germanies, earmarked $1 trillion over the next decade to complete that process, to be spent in rebuilding and restructuring and so forth of the East. I don't mean to imply that it was only a one-way street. West Germany actually had some things to learn from East Germany, and like in social services, mental health, a variety of areas. But in some important economic ways, there needed to be a flow in that direction. $1 trillion, $100 billion a year. All of the aid that Russia and Eastern Europe are getting from Japan and the United States and Western Europe put together it's probably a little over a tenth of that for a vastly larger land area and a vastly larger population of people. I mean, the aid that's going to those countries is not a fraction of what it could be and should be, just purely out of self-interest. I've having gone through national security programs and have a lot of friends in the military, have developed, I kind of look for questions that I can ask people in the State Department and the Pentagon that would sort of nudge them a little bit to think things differently. And I ask them, tell them, look, I know the military budget is largely pre-programmed. It's largely in place and sort of locked in. You can't tamper with much of it. Just even bureaucratically, I mean, they're bailiwicks that are defended by the people whose incomes are in those areas. But let's just suppose that Congress and the President and the Defense Secretary have some kind of zero-based capacity to think about how could we best use $260 billion plus for our national security. Would anybody deny that a fabulous use of 5% of that or 2% of that would be to give it to the Soviet Union to buy up, if necessary, all of their nuclear capability, to reduce that as fast as possible, and to put in whatever would bring about the maximum amount of stability for the buck in order to keep from happening any kind of a confrontation with the Soviet Union? Nobody I've presented that hypothetical problem to has disagreed that would be a primo use of that money. But of course, we can't conceive of doing that. I mean, it's not even on the same, when you put the money on the table, the different times in the congressional budget process, it doesn't happen on the same table. I mean, you can't even consider the possibility that would be a fabulous use of funds for our national security, just pure self-interest of the United States.
Can I ask a question? When you were talking about Bosnia, one of the things you didn't mention was the United Nations. So does what's happened there tell us something serious about the United Nations, and also the fact that
you know, along with nuclear war, biological warfare, chemical warfare, we would have thought World War II said genocide is no longer acceptable as a means of resolving any kind of any kind.
Right. I well could have said the United Nations. That I'll focus on just two things. One, the United Nations is in serious trouble of confusing two issues or not understanding just kind of the basic physics, the physical laws of the difference between peacekeeping and peacemaking. And there have been really quite a few articles in the popular press that have talked about it, and everybody that I've ever talked to over there or in the UN understands the importance that you can't conduct peacekeeping and then decide at some point that you're going to drive some wedge into a country to do some peacemaking, that is, to establish the peace. The UN historically has had a very wise policy of only going into a country on a peacekeeping mission when they're invited and when there is a peace agreement that they can help enforce. But to be in there and to have any part of their role to attempt to do peacemaking blurs a line that is better left very, very clear. I mean, the hostages were a highly predictable result of the bombing of a few sites, you know, by aircraft. All of those lives are in jeopardy as soon as you take sides in a conflict. I mean, it just, you're expecting too much of a process to mix those two.
But doesn't that mean that they should never have gone in believing they were doing peacekeeping? The only role would have been peacemaking from the beginning, or stopping genocide, or something.
Well, that is its only role. I mean, it's drawn that line just among the Western nations that have supplied much of the peacekeeping force and much of the leadership, by saying, no, those are U.S. planes, or those are French planes, not U.N. planes. But you can't tell that to the Serbs on the receiving end. The second thing about the UN that I think it's remarkable that the United Nations has done as well as it has, to be perfectly frank, there's a lot of things that make the United Nations right now in the 90s, the post-Cold War era, a less than a less adequate vehicle than its promise. First of all, it spent the first 50 years or 45 years of its life as a vehicle of the most powerful forces, the superpowers in the world, largely the U.S. for many, many years. I mean, in the 80s, we started pulling out of things that didn't meet our requirements or our interest, and to our great, I don't know, regret isn't the right word, but I think it's unfortunate that we've done that. And the second thing is that there are some problems just in the way the UN just functioned. I mean, just I've lobbied in and worked with and tried to influence the UN for long enough and close enough to the inside. I'm by no means an insider. I don't have huge amounts of experience there, but enough to see and to hear people that know more than I explain some of the difficulties. People don't get sent to be a nation's representative to the United Nations purely out of their great skills at diplomacy and negotiation. There are many people that serve in the UN who are little more than global party boys. I mean, it's a kind of a jet set club that is fun to be in, but they're not very good at peacekeeping and peacemaking and thinking about diplomacy. More than a few nations in the two-thirds world in particular find it a convenient place to, you know, like a new government comes into power and they think, what are we going to do with Joe Blow? And they think, I have an idea. We'll send him to the UN. We'll only have to deal with him like once a month rather than having him in our country. I mean, it was a way to bump people upstairs. Or to you know, to reward people for service in some fashion. We've had a few of those ourselves, you know, at various levels of the UN mission of the United States. So when you remember that, I mean, it's kind of remarkable how well it's done in the post-Cold War period, but it's really kind of finding its way in a new world for itself, but also with a lot of baggage that it's trying to unload from the Cold War. And then finally, the UN was meant to be a relatively weak instrument. It was never meant to have the capacity to overturn much in the way of what the superpowers wanted or the major powers. And in fact, you know, the veto power itself, you know, is so. It's important to remember that.
I mean, you were talking about little small ideas that could have big effects. Republicans who don't want to pay for U.S. policing the world recognize that actually giving the UN some freedom instead of making this a superpower hostage in some ways, that it would actually help.
Yeah. The problem is that there's a stronger fear on their part of giving up sovereignty, and it has a lot of roots that I could go into, but I mean, basically, that's the bottom line. I mean, it's expressed in the most extreme form in the kind of militia rumors and talk show conspiracy theories about how we're going to give the state of Idaho to the UN to set up a base camp to take over the United States and all this kind of crap. I mean, so that is, I don't think, in the sort of normal discourse, but it's really kind of sobering to read these fears, you know, of the far right about the UN sort of taking over the United States. I mean, there's a whole bunch of schemes and theories, each more harebrained than the last, but you know, disturbing, you know, that people could actually believe those things. So and I don't know, the agenda of the medium to far right is not even the very far right, the militia type right, but I mean the right in the political sphere in Washington even is really kind of scary in these kinds of terms. I mean, what the real result is and the real agenda is compared with what the rhetoric is are two different animals, and is a real problem. I mentioned that you could sort of take any one of these countries and look at the ways these different issues and sort of categories of issues impact the situation. I thought I would just take one, kind of a linking of two, the arms trade and an issue that's going to be up for a vote in July in the Senate on anti-personnel mines, or as they're more commonly called, landmines, since they're all on the land. And say a little bit about, several people mentioned, like, what is the United States doing, good or bad? And focus on one of the things that we're doing something that is very bad. I've laid out over here some fact sheets that can reinforce and give some of the data on what I'm about to say. The front row is probably the most useful, and the back row tends to be ones that go into a little bit more detail of one in one kind or another. But the I guess one way of putting it is, or starting the discussion about the arms trade is to look back all through the Cold War. Those of us that cared about what was happening in the two-thirds world were saying, you know, what are we doing selling huge amounts to Iran or Marcos or Noriega or Iraq or many of the other, you know, despots in the world? And the response that we always got was, well, you know, they've got a regional rival that's being backed by the Soviet Union, and to paraphrase Roosevelt, they're a despot, but they're our despot, you know. Lo and behold, the end of the Cold War comes, and not only does the arms trade, particularly to the Third World, not decline, it expands dramatically. in three different ways. First of all, where we were selling in constant dollars in the $8 to $15 billion range all through the 80s, and the Soviet Union about the same level. The end of the Cold War comes, and it's in the $25 to $60 billion range per year in constant dollars. This is, that's taking inflation out of the picture. A second way, it's even more disturbing, perhaps, where half of the arms trade went to NATO countries. Now, 85 to 90% in each of the 4 years since the end of the Cold War are going to authoritarian countries, are going to dictators, are going to countries with very bad human rights records. And where we sold to 50 or 60 countries in the Cold War, we've sold to 140 countries in each of the last 3 years or more. 141 one of the years. And finally, where during the Cold War, typically we would sell off the old equipment, the last generation of weapons, to make it a little easier to buy more larger quantities of the new equipment. We are now selling the top of the line equipment. The winning weapons of the Gulf War are the major, you know, core of what we're selling. We're selling the most advanced attack planes in the world, the F-15 and the F-16, and the bomber versions of the F-15, which are almost twice as big or twice as heavy as the fighter versions. In fact, there are 16 countries, easy to remember, that are in the business of building the F-16, either have full-fledged plants like South Korea or Taiwan or other countries, or have major, you know, we're building up the military-industrial complex in the two-thirds world. And we're, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, there would be maybe 100 or 150 countries that were applying for licenses for the technology to build something. According to the Wall Street Journal, the number of applications on the desks of the Commerce Department was in the 7,000 range a couple years ago, and it's gone up further since then. Many, many countries are, as part of the haggling and part of the bargaining, are wanting to build weapons within their country to give more of the jobs to their own people. What that does is just devastates the argument that we need the jobs. I mean, in many cases, the jobs aren't in the United States. You read the Seattle Times, as I did for the F-16 sale to Taiwan, I mean, to South Korea, for example, and it looked like this is going to be a great thing for our economy. And you read the Wall Street Journal and Business Week, where the longer articles tell you that, in fact, most of those planes will be built in South Korea. And there's another whole level of the economics that where a company will cut a deal for $2 billion to Finland or, you know, Greece or South Korea, and those are all actual examples. And 70 to 100% of the value of that arms deal will be given back to the country in terms of the economics, in helping them build up plants that will ultimately compete with U.S. plants on other terrain beyond the military. It's a whole aspect of the arms trade called offsets. And there's an article from the business section of the New York Times right in the front row next to this skinny little pink slips there. On the back side is the Wall Street Journal that I cited earlier, and both of them talk extensively about that. And right above it is a piece that I just finished a visit with Patty Murray, one of our senators. And one of the people that came along is a professor of business administration and marketing from the University of Washington. And he did a kind of a summary of what he's learned about offsets since he got involved with it. So that we're not even getting anything out of it on the economic side, which is always what drives this stuff. But what we're doing to the politics and the foreign policy and our own national security is devastating. It is terrible, what we're doing. It's the tragedy of the commons, if you know your philosophical lingo. That is the intense interest of a few military contractors and their very well-developed capacity to mobilize political constituencies, a few workers and a few politicians and a bunch of industry executives, you know, meeting with their member of Congress on the one hand, and the less intense interest of the American public to having both our economic situation driven further into the ground on the one hand, and our the national security and moral issues really tattered by these tremendous sales of military technology to the most unstable countries in the world. I mean, another one of those questions that I've asked friends and acquaintances in the State Department and the Pentagon. Saudi Arabia has been our biggest customer this decade, as Iran was in the 70s. And I said, do you yourself know or can assure me, or do you know anyone in the State Department or the Pentagon who could assure me that they know who's going to be in power in Saudi Arabia in 5 or 10 years? And there's either silence or kind of a nervous laugh at the other end of the phone.
Is it also a rationale for why we need still another new generation of extraordinarily expensive weapons to counter old weapons that are we now are only on parity?
Definitely. The Pentagon's list of countries that have advanced weapons that justifies our, I mean, it's literally in congressional testimony, is matches very closely to the list of countries we've sold to. Or you take the list of 45 countries that have had, there are two different versions of this, and I'll quote one of the one that's over here. There are 48 ethnic conflicts underway around the world as of mid-1993. 39 had received United States weapons. In many cases, both sides of a conflict is being armed by the United States. So here's an issue, the arms trade, that has become the leading issue of the peace movement. I mean, I just came back from a conference of some 800 people held at the same time as the UN Non-Proliferation Treaty meetings and renewal of the treaty and so forth, where some 70 major national organizations and several hundred major regional peace organizations have made this one of their priorities. I mean, this could be the freeze of the next couple years in terms of an issue. And it's one that, you know, we Lutherans, we concerned Americans need to be involved in. I mean, the issue is so clear cut. The polling numbers are so overwhelming on our side. I mean, a publicly commissioned poll showed that 94 or 96% of those people polled said that we should not sell tanks, HAC helicopters, and other, you know, modern weapons to dictators. I mean, the public support is there. The logic is there. What's lacking is that it hasn't yet broken through the consciousness of the political, you know, structure. I mean, the middle of the road Congress people who could vote for something like this haven't gotten the idea yet. And we have 100 and some representatives and almost a dozen senators that have already co-sponsored the bill. I mean, we're well along the way to building the kind of support that would end arms sales to dictators, defined as countries that commit aggression against neighbors or their own people, countries that do not have democratic structures, companies that violate the State Department's own definition of, you know, systematic violation of human rights, or that don't participate in the UN efforts to begin to give some transparency and control of the arms trade. It's a very simple 10-page bill. We did a test vote. Cynthia McKinney is the House principal sponsor and attached it as an amendment to another bill this last month, and 157 members of Congress voted in favor of it. I mean, we're getting to the point where it's a viable legislative vehicle and a place where we can engage the system to put up or shut up. But it's really up to us at the grassroots to raise the visibility of this issue and to make this something, you know, that forces our politicians to to decide, you know, what side they're going to be on. Are they going to be on the side of arming dictators, or are they going to be on the side of national security and international security? I think it's one of the leading kind of issues, and it has a very intimate relationship with military training. Those of you who have followed the School of the Americas fight over the last couple years, that also took a kind of a leap forward when this last year, through the Freedom of Information Act, a really small group, smaller than probably sits around the room here, through Freedom of Information Act, got the lists of all of the graduates of this School of the Americas, which trains officers in Latin American countries in so-called counterinsurgency techniques, and matched them up with the UN listings of people that they fingered as being responsible for the killing of Archbishop Romero, the killing of the six Jesuit priests and the two workers in their house, etc. And the majority of the people that were determined to be responsible by the UN were graduates of this school. I mean, the evidence is very, very sobering. And those two are really two peas in a pod. I mean, they just go hand in hand. You don't sell anybody equipment anymore only. Half the deal is often spare parts and training. And they represent the U.S. military's self-interest in having as deep an interpenetration into the militaries of any country around the world as they can for a whole host of reasons. But with some very nefarious consequences, and ones that are really highlighted by this School of the Americas campaign to try to basically defund it and close it down and end it.
You've uncovered, of course, the most sophisticated counter-argument to all of this, which is, why do we sell arms to dictators? Well, we do because how can you get a coup in dictatorship? Well, there's only one way, to influence the military. How do you influence the military? You have a relationship with them through arms, and then maybe one day they'll be your guys and do something you want.
Right.
None of this ever worked in any known example, but right. That's the rationale.
And a piece of that I wrestle with how to open up the issue without in a limited kind of a time space, either here or particularly when I speak in congregations. But another really sad reality of that is that, you know, for whatever reasons, I won't try to speculate, in this short time, but the United States military or political leadership that works directly on these kinds of issues have found it convenient to work with dictatorships rather than democracies. And it is in stark contrast to our rhetoric, you know, which is, why are we going over there and pick your country and plug it into the blank space? Well, to support democracy. Pick a country if you doubt, and let's talk about what we've actually done and compare it with our rhetoric.
I was really naive because I always thought a lot of this stuff was behind closed doors and kind of secret deals between sort of evil people. But then when we were living in Cairo for 3 years, it was just like a county fair. I mean, you rope off 30 acres of the Cairo, or 50, 60 acres of the Cairo exposition grounds.
Right.
And different people just bring in their, different countries bring in their stuff like booths at a county fair. And people, military representatives from all over the world just come and sample the goodies and haggle. It was really, nothing behind the... I mean, I suppose it's behind-the-scenes stuff, but so much of it is just kind of out there, just like, you know, buying crochet work at the booth or something.
I got an action alert less than a month ago about $500,000 of our tax money was going to be spent to ferry a bunch of planes and 20 of our most advanced fighters to Paris for the Paris Air Show. And, you know, how many other sectors of our economy, agricultural implements, computers, foodstuffs, petroleum products, get subsidies from the United States to much, that's just the cash, that's also all of those troops and, you know, standing by the winning weapons in the Gulf War and so forth to sell products. And the irony is that in order to make a few dollars for a few defense contractors, as I described earlier, the according to the Wall Street Journal and the business section of the New York Times, the economic advantages to us as a country, as a whole, are very dubious. But why are we subsidizing the incomes of a few defense contractors when the real bucks in international trade, and not tens of billions, but hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars, like high-definition television and fiber optics, and we could brainstorm a list very quickly here, are not getting, you know, much in the way of federal subsidy. I mean, why in a democracy isn't the future direction of our economy and the strength of our economy a matter of public debate, where we could choose not to put money into something that has so many other moral and national security implications that are negative, but we're subsidizing those kinds of things? Why can't we have a public debate about where should economic subsidies go? And we'd come up with a different, solution. Well, this chart was done in right at the turn of the decade, before the last 4 years, when we see the, you know, some of the horrible things that have happened in terms of supporting the militaries. It was back when world military expenditures were in the $1 trillion range. It's now about 2/3 of $1 trillion, $660 billion. But the same concept is I think useful. I should really drop them a line and see if they have an updated one. And basically, each one of these represent 0.1% of the world military spending. That is about $1 billion, or 2/3 of $1 billion now. And once you've sort of grasped the structure of this chart, the basic idea, it becomes really like awesome. I mean, basic idea is this whole square in 4 years ago represented military spending, or almost exactly this part represents current military spending. Now, what would happen if we would just use one small part of it, like a shape the size of this, of that military spending, would solve or alleviate or just totally transform what we're doing about soil erosion, or stabilizing population, or retiring developing nations' debt, or providing clean, safe water for the entire world's population? The single largest reason why children die is unsafe water and the diseases that are associated with that. I mean, really, almost a conspicuous proportion of that total military spending. So here's the moral and larger international relations and stability of the world tragedy. Either for moral reasons or for self-interest reasons, if we could reduce even a fraction of that military spending and free it up, what could we do? I mean, it's just awesome how tiny a part of that. And yet, what we're doing by this unbridled interest in selling arms is fomenting and stealing, you know, like Eisenhower said, you know, every gun that is built, every ship that is launched, that is not needed for national security, is stealing from the mouths of the hungry, is stealing from the shelter over and roof over the heads of the homeless, is depriving children of the right and the ability to reach the age of 5. The numbers are so powerful that, and you know, I there was a time years ago when I found that just profoundly depressing. Well, the truth is that we have this kind of laissez-faire kind of arena that these decisions take place in. I believe there are villains, but by and large, they're victims of processes that are going on that no one person ever decided on. It benefits them. They support it because it helps them. I mean, if you were working for an arms manufacturer, your job would be to bring in business, right? But the more I've worked with this, and the more I've worked on Capitol Hill as well as out in the countryside, the more actually inspiring or optimistic I find myself feeling about data like this. I mean, the truth is really that there is enough money in the world for all of our needs. There is enough money in the federal budget for all of our needs. There isn't enough money for things that aren't needed. And really modest changes in the picture will produce major benefits. We're in the process in Seattle of doing charts that were kind of a staple of the Cold War. You know, one less B-2 bomber or Seawolf submarine would buy us or would double the budget for, all of these other things. I think that it's possible, even in the current political alignments in Washington, for us to succeed on things like passing the Arms Trade Code of Conduct bill that would end arms sales to dictators unless Congress and the President both publicly debated and chose to say it's in our national security interest to sell to these countries anyway. I mean, it's a very well-written bill that it doesn't just stuff something down the throats of the military. It's not an anti-Pentagon bill. It's a pro, you know, democracy bill. It's a pro, let's be conscious of what we're doing and have a public debate about these things. In the 20 years since the two laws that define the selling of arms in the Third World, the Arms Export Control Act and the Foreign Assistance Act, were first passed in the mid-70s, in the roughly their current form anyway, Congress has not once overturned an effort to sell weapons to any country in the world. And for all the excuses that were given in the Cold War, there are no excuses for not having public debate about this now, for not having a democracy function in the area of the arms trade now. The current law doesn't even require Congress to get involved unless it chooses to. And when an arms deal is announced, it has 30 calendar days to decide if it wants to do something, to hold hearings, to build up support for a particular bill, to write and craft the legislation, to run it through all the committees that are involved, to have the floor votes, and then if it doesn't win by 2/3 vote in both houses of Congress, it doesn't pass. Well, that process is so, difficult. I mean, that would be like saying, you get to do it if you can successfully run over each of the mountains surrounding Holden Village, and get back here, you know, by sundown or something. I mean, that's the kind of process that Congress knowingly set up for itself to deal with this. I mean, that's not democracy anymore. And this would change that picture to be one where the State Department's own lists of human rights abusing or totalitarian countries would be in play. It's plenty for me for the present to basically stop an arms deal unless Congress and the President votes otherwise.
It seems like what they're ratcheting down instead, they're spending all this time ratcheting down this stuff.
Yes, exactly.
Housing, healthcare, the environment, school lunches, all this stuff.
Exactly.
That's what they're spending all their time sending through committees.
Exactly, right, right. I mean, I am more hopeful now than I have been in years because, the possibilities are right in front of us, and the barriers that dogged us all through the Cold War don't exist. The only barrier is our inability to speak to our neighbors, to talk to our adult forum, to get a few groups together to go have a meeting with our member of Congress, to write that letter to the editor in the newspaper. I mean, that's, when I compare that to the struggles that that I would face if I was trying to be the head of Lutheran Peace Fellowship in Yugoslavia, let's say, or Guatemala, you know, or Pakistan or something. Hey, you know, I can do that. I can write that letter to the editor. I can overturn the various weaknesses and fears and barriers that I've got in my life and get out there and do it. I mean, I want something that's been in my mind for the last year. What would it have been like to have been a member of Lutheran Peace Fellowship in Germany in the 30s? Things look real different when you put it in that light. I mean, we have the possibility of doing peacemaking and succeeding for in some ways the first time in memory. That's the opportunity of the post-Cold War. We're up against some principalities and powers of a fairly significant durability and strength. But, you know, if the South Africans could continue the struggle to victory and to win a nonviolent change in their political priorities and their structure and who was at the table making their decisions, we have no excuses that carry any water anyway. I've got lots of excuses, but we have no excuses that we ought to listen to and believe